1 Samuel 30-31, the 22nd talk in a series in 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on February 1, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm planning to finish 1 Samuel today, last two chapters. In the text last time, the Philistines decided they were on the eve of a battle with the Israelites. They decided that they did not want David and his men to fight with them, and so they sent them back. Chapter 30 describes what happened when David and his men returned to Ziklag, where they had been living. The first section. Then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag, and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. Now David's two wives had been taken captive, Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord, his God. Okay, it was at Aphek, which was just southwest of where the big battle was going to take place, that David had gone with the Philistines, and they were making their plans, preparing to go up to the Valley of Jezreel, where the battle was going to happen. David was turned back by the Philistine lords. They did not want him to participate in the battle with them. They were afraid that he would not be loyal to them. So David and his men start making their way back to Ziklag, to the south, into the Negev. And it's about a three-day march to go from Aphek to Ziklag. When he arrives back after this three-day march, he discovers that Ziklag has been laid waste. It's been destroyed. It's been burned by the Amalekites, and they have looted the place. Now, the Amalekites were this tribe that lived in the Negev. It is possible that when David and his men, over the last year and a half or so, as they've been going out on raids on a regular basis, they've been raiding non-Israelite areas and non-Philistine areas. So they've been raiding Canaanites, and it's possible that they also raided Amalekite villages. So the Amalekites are seeing this, David's absence and the Philistines' absence from this area, as an opportunity. They're going to take advantage of the fact that the Philistines are fighting against the Israelites way up to the north, and they're going to carry out a number of raids through the Negev. They raid a number of Israelite villages, and they conclude their raiding with a raid on Ziklag. They take all of the people captive rather than killing them. The Amalekites were slave traders. That was part of their money-making activities. So obviously their thinking is, we'll take them alive, we'll sell them. They're more valuable to us alive than dead. So they've taken all of them captive, man, woman, and child, and they've headed south. So when David and his men arrive in Ziklag, they see the city absolutely destroyed, and everybody's gone. And they are obviously overcome with grief because they've lost their wives and their families. David among them. David has also lost his two wives. But David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. In addition to mourning the fact that his family has been gone, the people, the other men, are talking about stoning him to death. For all the people were embittered. So there's a sense in which it's understandable. They are very upset, and they want to give expression to that distress that they feel. But the thing they come up with is stoning David. Here's a quote from Robert Alter, who has written a translation of 1 and 2 Samuel. He says, "This moment is also a vivid reminder, as are others in the Saul-David story, of how precarious political power is. David, the charismatic and brilliant commander who has led his men through a host of dangers, suddenly discovers that these hard-bitten warriors are ready to kill him because of the disastrous turn of events." It is strange here that now, after all that's happened and all that David has accomplished along with his men, that they would turn on him at this point in time. What's interesting to me is that it doesn't say that they decide to murder him. It doesn't say that they decide to assassinate him, but they're talking about stoning him. Stoning is not an assassination, it's an execution. It's a form of execution for a crime. So the way they're thinking about it, David has committed a crime, not just been stupid. What is the nature of this crime? It's possible that what the soldiers are thinking, his men are thinking, is that David, when he came to Philistia in the first place, a year and a half earlier, had made a mistake. That was the wrong thing for him to do. And that now, a year and a half later, it has brought them to the place where events have so unfolded that their families and children have been taken away. It's possible that's what they have in mind. I'm inclined to think that it's more than that. I'm inclined to think that they are particularly upset about the whole event surrounding Aphek, going up to Aphek in the first place. I mentioned this last time, but let me develop my thinking a little bit more. David went with the Philistines up to Aphek in preparation for fighting against the Israelites. He went at the request of his Philistine overlord, Achish, to whom David has been serving for a year and a half. He goes there with Achish's full support. He has convinced Achish that he is a faithful servant of Achish, even though we know from the text that David has not been a faithful servant of Achish. But the other Philistine lords, when they see David and his men coming with Achish, they say, "This is ridiculous. These Hebrews are going to turn against us when we get in the battle. It's too dangerous to have them along with us. We want them to leave. We want them to go back to Ziklag." When Achish announces that to David, David protests and says, "What have I done? Why are you sending me back?" Now, either he's just carrying on his charade of being loyal, but is glad to not have to fight against the Israelites, or, and this is what I think is more likely, he wanted to go into that battle. He wanted to go with the Philistines. That what he saw happening was an opportunity. I think it's very clear David would never have fought against the Israelites. He would never have fought against Saul. But I suspect that he saw this as another opportunity where he could show his loyalty to Israel and to Saul. That at the right moment in the battle, he would have turned against the Philistines and come to the aid of the Israelites. This would be in keeping with the strategies that he has used up to now. On two different occasions, in the cave and then when Saul came and the 3,000 men were sleeping around Saul, David, I'll just use the latter case, David snuck into the camp at night to where Saul was, right in the middle of 3,000 soldiers, where he could have easily killed Saul. And in fact, the man that was with him encouraged him to do so. But he didn't. He took the spear and the water jug, and they snuck back out. And then the next day, David spoke to the men of Israel and said, I've got the spear and I've got the water jug. I could have killed Saul, but I didn't because I'm loyal to him. So he used an opportunity where he could easily, and it would have been much to his advantage, to do damage to Saul, but he didn't because of his loyalty to Saul. I think he saw this as the same kind of opportunity. He could have marched up to this battle with the Philistines and been in a position to help the Philistines destroy the Israelites and Saul. But he would not participate in that. He would turn against the Philistines and actually help save them. I think that's what David had in mind. So when he's told, go back, he's actually disappointed that an opportunity that he thought was shaping up for him to prove not only to Saul, but the whole nation of Israel, that he was loyal to them, that whole opportunity is slipping away and it's not going to be possible. If that's the case, my suspicion is then that his soldiers, some of them, are looking at this series of decisions that David has made, and they're thinking, he is irresponsible. He is doing things that are high risk. And they're not just high risk to him, they're high risk to all of us. And he has no right to make those kinds of choices. Remember when he snuck into the camp in the night, there were two men that he asked if they would go with him. One of them volunteered to go with him. In doing so, that was a high-risk action. But he was risking two people's lives, his own and a volunteer who said that he would go. Now, if I'm understanding this correctly, this is another high-risk decision, but he's taking 600 men who didn't volunteer for this particular mission. And I think that's why the way they're seeing it, this was a crime. David was extremely irresponsible in choosing to take this high-risk action. So they want to kill him. David is distressed by the fact that they want to kill him. But, interestingly, he derives his strength from God, that he turns to God in this particular situation. His conscience is clear before God. He was not being careless of the lives of his men, but he was trying to do what God wanted him to do. And therefore, before God, his conscience is clear. He knows that he's not guilty of the irresponsibility that the men are accusing him of. Next section. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, please bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them? And he said to him, "Pursue, for you shall surely overtake them, and you shall surely rescue all." So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those left behind remained. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200, who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor, remained behind. So David has a plan. Obviously, he's thinking quickly, but he's decided, let's go get him. But as has been the case throughout, both Saul and David feel obligated before they go into conflict to consult of the Lord. I will point out, there's no indication that David consulted of the Lord before going up to Aphek to go with the Philistines, which I think is interesting. But in this case, he before chasing the Amalekites, which is probably a long shot. The Amalekites have probably been gone for about 3 days. They have a three-day head start. And David's men have just marched for 3 days, so they're probably tired. So it's probably a long shot. So that's what he does consult of God. He has the priest consult the Urim and Thummim, ask whether they should go after these Amalekites. And the response is, yes, go after them, and you will get them. So David and his men are probably very encouraged by that news, and they take off. And they get about, I think it's about a day's march further south to the brook Besor. And when they get to that point, of the 600 men that are with David, about 200 of them don't think they can go any further. They're exhausted. So David leaves them there with whatever supplies they had. And by the way, with Ziklag having been destroyed, they probably were unable to resupply. So they're probably short on rations as well as tired. 200 stay there with whatever supplies they had, and the other 400 continue on. Next section. Now they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread and he ate, and they provided him water to drink. And they gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins and he ate. Then his spirits revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. And David said to him, "To whom do you belong and where are you from?" And he said, "I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite. And my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. We made a raid on the Negev of the Chernethites and on that which belongs to Judah and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." Then David said to him, "Will you bring me down to this band?" And he said, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band." So, as they proceed, they come across this man who's on the verge of death. He's an Egyptian that they found in the field. They don't know who he is. They don't know really anything about him. But they decide to feed him and revive him. And they feed him not just bread and water. They feed him more than that. And he revives. His spirits revive as a result of receiving food and drink. It's at that point then that David inquires, "Who are you?" And what he says is he was a slave of an Amalekite. He got sick, and so they abandoned him, just left him in the desert to die. But he had been with them when the Amalekites had conducted their raids in the Negev, and they had raided Israelite villages, villages of Judah and the villages of Caleb. And then they had concluded with their raid on Ziklag and burned it. So David knows that this is the same, he was with the same group of Amalekites that had destroyed Ziklag and had taken all of the people as captives. And so David says, would you show us, would you lead us to where this band is? And he says, yeah, I will, if you will not kill me, and if you will not deliver me over to my master. By all appearances, the Amalekites weren't good to their slaves. He doesn't want to be turned back to his master, and probably especially if he has helped the Israelites, helped the Hebrews, helped David. So now they have someone who can potentially lead them to this band of Amalekites. Next section. And when he had brought him down, behold, they were spread over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. But nothing of theirs was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that they had taken for themselves. David brought it all back. So David had captured all the sheep and the cattle which the people drove ahead of the other livestock. And they said, this is David's spoil. Okay, they locate the tribe, they catch up with them, and they conduct a raid probably in the dawn. At the break of day, they conduct a raid on the Amalekite village. They were spread out, so they weren't expecting a counterattack, and they were partying. And as soon as dawn comes, David and his men rush in, and they kill the Amalekites. They slaughtered them. And it's not clear. I think the slaughter lasts all of the daylight hours, but the Hebrew is a little difficult. It could be that it goes for 24 hours. And it says that not a man of them escaped except 400 young men on camels. Except 400 young. That's a big army if it's except for 400 young men that get away. So apparently the Amalekites had a pretty large army of which only 400 escaped. And David and his men are able to recover absolutely everything that they had taken from Ziklag. Every man, woman, and child, all the possessions, all of the livestock that they had taken from Ziklag, in addition to the loot that they had gathered in the other villages. So this is a huge amount of stuff that they have now taken possession of. And now David's the hero. Just a couple days earlier, he was the goat. Now he's the hero. And this is David's spoil then that they are herding off back to Ziklag. Next section. When David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, who had also been left at the brook Besor, and they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him, then David approached the people and greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men among those who went with David answered and said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. Then David said, you must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered us and has delivered into our hand the band that came against us. And who will listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike. And so it has been from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. So he comes back to where they had left the 200 men to guard their supplies. And they're bringing all of this loot. And men who are with David are saying, you know, it's not fair for us to share all this stuff with these 200 slackers who didn't come and fight. They didn't risk their lives. They stayed back here. There's no reason that we should share it with them. We'll give them their wives and their children back, but that's it. They don't deserve any more than that. David's response is, you don't understand how we got this loot. That in fact, it isn't something that we earned by our skill. Our skill was involved for sure, but it is not by virtue of our skill primarily that we got this stuff. This was a gift from God. God made this possible. And we can't lose sight of that fact. And those who stayed behind not because they weren't brave enough. It was because they were tired. That could have been the case with any one of us. And they contributed to the effort. By guarding our supplies, they were making a contribution to our attack on the Amalekites. Because had there been no one here to guard our supplies, it would not be here when we came back. So from David's perspective, these men also contributed to the effort. These men also ought to share in the spoils. This is particularly interesting because it is, let's see, what kind of man is it? Wicked and worthless men. It's wicked and worthless men among them that are making this suggestion. These wicked and worthless men are driven by the motive of greed. They want more stuff. It is probably some of these same wicked and worthless men who just a couple days earlier wanted to stone David to death. And now they're saying it's not fair that we have to share this loot. David is willing to stand up against these wicked and worthless men. As opposed to, and if you remember back to Saul in chapter 14, where God had told Saul to destroy all of the Amalekites and to kill all of the animals. But there were some among the Israelites who argued with Saul, saying, we shouldn't kill all the animals. We should let the animals live. Look, there's a lot of meat here that we could use to our benefit, and we can sacrifice to God with it. So let's keep it. And Saul listened to the voice of the men and allowed the animals to live. And it's for that that Saul is condemned. David here doesn't listen to the voice of the wicked and worthless men. He stands up to them, even though just a couple days earlier they had threatened to kill him. Next section. Now when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord, to those who were in Bethel and to those who were in Ramoth of the Negev and to those who were in Jatir and to those who were in Aror and to those who were in Siphmoth and to those who were in Eshtemoah and to those who were in Rakal and to those who were in the cities of the Jerahmeelites and to those who were in the cities of the Kenites and to those who were in Hormah and to those who were in Borashan and to those who were in Athak and to those who were in Hebron and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go. So David takes some of the spoil and divvies it up among the villages in Judah that had befriended David. David has been running from Saul for years. For most of that time, he's been in Judah. And in order to support themselves, they were going on out on raids, and I assume they're going out on raids against, I know they were going out on raids against other villages, not Israelite villages, not villages of Judah. I suspect, though, that he also received help from those villages in Judah, that they were probably providing some supplies to David and his men over this period of time that allowed them to sustain themselves throughout those years. David is showing his gratitude here. So with the extra loot that they have brought back, he's divvying some of that up and giving it out to the villages that have been good to them over the years. And it was kind of a two-way street. David's men were also protecting those areas. And so David has done much to ingratiate himself to those villages in the southern part of Judah. Now, chapter 31 switches back to the big battle, the battle between the Philistines and the Israelites that takes place in the Valley of Jezreel. Now, the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his men, and the Philistines killed Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and pierce me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and pierce me through and make sport of me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died with his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men on that day together. So the battle takes place, the Philistines just to the north of the Israelites coming from Mount Gilboa. They meet in battle. The Philistines end up routing the Israelites. They kill a large number of them, and those that are left apparently retreat back to Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines pursue them. And in their pursuit, they're able to kill all of Saul's three sons. There's still one more son of Saul that we'll run into in 2 Samuel. But the three oldest, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, are all killed in this battle. Saul is also hard-pressed. He's been hit by arrows. He's wounded, and he knows that it's just a matter of time. So Saul asks his armor bearer, and his armor bearer would have been a valiant soldier. He isn't just someone who goes around carrying his sword, but he's a valiant soldier in his own right. Saul turns to him and says, "Look, it's all over. Kill me. I'd rather be killed than to be tortured to death at the hands of the Philistines. Have to endure a slow and painful death. Just off me right now, please." The armor bearer will not do it. And it's not clear why. It's not clear whether it's just social taboo, whether it's out of personal loyalty to Saul, or whether it is a recognition that Saul is the anointed and that he has no right, even under these circumstances. He has no right to take the life of Saul. But in any case, the armor bearer will not kill Saul. So Saul feels like he has no choice. He's not going to allow himself to be tormented by the Philistines. And he falls on his sword, takes his own life. The armor bearer does likewise. He sees that Saul has died, and he also falls on his sword. In this battle, Saul, his sons, and it says all of his men. It's not clear what all of his men means. But remember, he had this army of 3,000 men that went after David. They're his standing army, or nearly standing army. And it could be that army, or all of it, or the vast majority of it was destroyed. But that army was the army of Israel. That was the heart of the army of Israel. So Israel has been soundly defeated, and the Philistines have free sway at this point. Saul had been told that he would die in this battle, that he and his sons would die in this battle. It's interesting to me that Saul nevertheless went out to fight. It's not clear whether he just resigned himself to this fate, whether he felt, whether there was kind of a change of heart in him and he felt obligated to go to battle. It's not clear exactly what motivated him, but he did go to battle. But what was predicted came to pass. The last section. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley with those who were beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. Then the Philistines came and lived in them. And it came about on the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his weapons and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. And they put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. Now when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men rose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. When the Philistines have routed the Israelite army, now the Philistines can control all of the valley of Jezreel, all of the land north of the valley of Jezreel, and they can control the Jordan Valley. So what they're controlling is all of the main ways of travel through Palestine. The Valley of Jezreel is absolutely the crossroads of all those paths in Palestine, and that's what the Philistines apparently wanted in particular. But also the valley, the Jordan Valley, is another place of travel. So now all of the Israelites that were living in the villages in those areas, they realize there's no hope for them. So they just abandon their cities and probably go south into other Israelite villages. The Philistines sweep in and they start living in each of those villages. They inhabit that area. They have conquered, they have taken over. Furthermore, that the next day after the battle, they go to the battleground, surveying the battleground, and they find the body of Saul and his sons. And they take the armor of Saul and his sons, and they lop off Saul's head, and they send those things to the Philistine cities as proof that the Philistines completely destroyed the Israelites. And they take their bodies, Saul's body and his son's bodies, and they hang them on the city wall of, of Bethshan. Apparently a kind of public declaration that this territory now belongs to the Philistines and a way of disgracing Saul and his sons. Well, the Israelites in Jabesh-Gilead hear that this has happened and that Saul's body and his sons are all displayed against this wall. This was one of the first villages that Saul had come to the aid of when Saul was first in the process of claiming his kingship. And he had defeated their tormentors. So in thanks, the brave men of Jabesh-Gilead, they make their way to Bethshan. They take down the bodies. They take them back home. And they give them a proper burial. And they give them the honor that they're due. Okay. That's the way that the first book of Samuel ends. There is not a huge line between 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. It could have been one continuous text. 2 Samuel picks up right where 1 Samuel leaves off. But this apparently seemed to be a good breaking point, the death of Saul, was a good place to change from one scroll to the next. So that's why we have 1 and 2 Samuel. But I think that this is probably a good place to reflect a little bit about what's in 1 Samuel and what's going on here. I want to say something with respect to David, something with respect to Saul, and then something with respect to Jonathan. If I'm understanding the text correctly, David is being portrayed here as a man of action. That is, someone who gets things done. It has been striking to me in reading history over the years that most men of action share the same motto, whether they say they do or not. But Napoleon, who became Emperor of France, and Vladimir Lenin, the Russian who led the Russian Revolution, they both had the same motto. In French, it's on s'engage et puis on va, which means one engages in battle and then you see what happens. That it is futile to think in terms of planning out a battle. It can't be done. Because as soon as the first engagement happens, the situation has changed in ways that you could not have predicted. So to plan it out is futile. You take action, you see what happens, and you respond to the next set of circumstances that present themselves. If you operate differently, you will be paralyzed. That's the only way you can proceed, because we aren't smart enough to be able to predict everything that's going to happen. Napoleon and Lenin certainly operated according to that principle. Julius Caesar operated according to that principle. I think any man of action in history has done the same thing. But there is a significant difference between David and Napoleon and Lenin. First of all, he didn't know French. But Napoleon and Lenin, their confidence is in their skill. That they believe that they have the smarts and the skills to be able to make the adjustments that are necessary in order to proceed intelligently through this difficult situation and fluid situation. David seems to be thinking about it a little bit differently. You take action, and then you kind of see what God seems to be opening up. That it's not trust in his skill as much as it is trust in God's ability to lead him through this maze of difficulties. So David is just looking at each situation, what seems to be the prudent action to take. You take it and then see how things develop and repeat that process and keep repeating that process. So if he thinks that what's opening up is an opportunity for him to go up to the valley of Jezreel and go into battle with the Philistines against the Israelites. And when the right time comes, he'll turn. If that plan fails, then you do plan B. If that door is closed, if that opportunity isn't going to happen, then you turn on a dime and you go in a different direction. And David just seems to be proceeding through life that way. Going into Philistia in the first place was this kind of thing. He didn't know what was going to happen. But he didn't see any other option available to him. So he goes into Philistia and becomes the servant of a Philistine king. Saul. I don't know if Saul ever came to faith. I've commented on this before. I don't know that we can tell. It doesn't take long to become a man of faith. Saul could have become a man of faith on the day of the battle. Saul could have come to the point of repentance and acknowledgement of who God is during the day of battle and died, and we will see him in heaven. I do not know. And I don't think the text tells us. The fact that he commits suicide, I don't think tells us one way or the other. Suicide, I believe, is wrong. But as Jack has, a distinction that Jack has made that is helpful to me is there's a difference between a failure of courage and a failure of faith. That it is possible to be faithful and yet have a failure of courage in a moment and do something that one ought not do. So the fact that Saul takes his own life is definitely a failure of courage. I'm not sure that it's a failure of faith. So all I'm saying is I don't think the text tells us whether in the end Saul came to terms with God or not. But the text does portray Saul as one who was throughout most of his life a faithless man. But he's an interesting faithless man in that he is very religious. There's a sense in which I suppose if you were to go up and ask him, do you trust in Yahweh? He would have said, absolutely. Look at my sacrifices. Because he had done the things that were required religiously, that he was a faithful man, that he was a man of God. But the narrative actually portrays him differently. And in particular, it condemns him for not killing all of the men, women, and children in the Amalekite village that they were to attack and the livestock. He listened to the men who wanted to save the livestock rather than doing what God had told him to do. So Saul is a story of tragedy. He had great promise from the beginning, but he couldn't quite come to the place where he trusted God implicitly. He's always insecure in his position as king, afraid that the people will overthrow him one way or another. And so he capitulates even to the wicked and worthless men among them. If we look at this, there's a short account that is given of Saul's last days and his death in 1 Chronicles 10. I will not read the whole thing, but I will just read two verses out of it where it sums up his life as soon as I find it. 1 Chronicles 10, and I'll just read 13 and 14. So Saul died for his trespass which he committed against the Lord, because of the word of the Lord which he did not keep, and also because he asked counsel of a medium, making inquiry of it, and did not inquire of the Lord. Therefore he killed him and turned the kingdom to David, the son of Jesse. As you go through 1 Samuel, you could get the impression that God turned against Saul for one act, and that was for his failure to wipe out the Amalekites and all the animals. But as we look in 1 Chronicles, there's another violation that's added, and that was consulting the medium. That is not mentioned as 1 Samuel. I think when you put all the pieces together, Saul was not condemned for a single act. But that single act is used to be representative of Saul's life as a whole. And consulting the medium is just another representative act of Saul's inability or refusal to trust God implicitly. And that is quite in contrast with David in the way that he's depicted in 1 Samuel. Now, just a little bit about Jonathan. Jonathan doesn't get much ink in 1 Samuel. He isn't mentioned all that much. But I find him a remarkable character nevertheless. Jonathan is the son of Saul. But Jonathan recognizes that David is something special. That David has been touched by God. David has a different spirit in him. And Jonathan really responds to that and resounds with that. And as a result, David, or Jonathan, is devoted to David and devoted to David throughout his life. But he is also devoted to his father and loyal to his father throughout his father's life. It's a difficult thing, balance for him. He's caught in a really tough spot. But he's loyal to Saul and he's loyal to David because he is also loyal and committed to God. There is a point in time, early in 1 Samuel, when Jonathan, the last time he sees David, he's talking with David, and he says, I know that you are going to become king. You will replace my father. And Jonathan says, and I will be your right-hand man. That's one of the saddest lines in 1 Samuel because it never happens. That the first part of his prediction does happen. David does become king. But the second part of his prediction doesn't happen. Jonathan never is given the opportunity to be David's right-hand man. I find that very sad, but it's not because he wasn't worthy. Throughout the whole narrative, Jonathan is a very noble man. He is very loyal to God primarily, but also to David and Saul. Very admirable. Okay, questions, comments?
Earlier it had mentioned that David's band of merry men contained everybody that had a bone to pick, right?
Yep.
So apparently his group sort of had this motley crew,
yes,
arrangement of, like, some of these guys were, you know, loyal, God-fearing Israelites, and others were like, well, you know, you feed us, we'll fight for you, kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they go out there and they rescue all the women and children that have been taken by the Amalekites and come back. It strikes me as odd that there would be any fight at all over the spoil, because they're just returning it to the people who got it stolen from them to begin with, weren't they?
Right.
So this is David's spoil. No, it's not. It's his neighbor's property and their neighbor's property, and we're just bringing it back to him. How come that never gets brought up, that we're just returning what was taken? This is not ours to keep or to divvy up or to have say over.
Yeah. Well, fairness is a strange thing. Fairness varies a lot depending on what perspective you're looking at it from. I'm sure by the way that they have lived their lives, they have supplied themselves by raiding villages. Is it fair that they take that loot and that they claim it to be their own? The people they took it from certainly wouldn't consider that fair. So it's they're living under these rules of piracy, and it belongs to the one who took it. And I suspect that's the way they're looking at it. I think what David's primary corrective here is, it's not ours. It isn't ours by virtue of what great fighters we are. And that needs to be taken into consideration in the divvying up of the loot. And they don't divide it up just among, they end up returning the stuff to each person who lives in Ziklag. But the rest of the loot that had been taken from other villages, that gets divided up, and I'm sure some of David's men get a share of that because that's the way they've lived for years. But a portion of that then is going to be returned to the various villages that have been loyal to David over the years. There are a lot of fairnesses that could have been argued in this situation, as in any situation. Go again. There's the mic.
It kind of reminds me of what we see happening in the war in Afghanistan. The special forces come into town, and they have all these supplies and whatnot, and they say, so who's the village elder here?
Mm-hmm.
And they give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he's got the village watching him, and he can create all sorts of goodwill. Well, I'm going to give this family this much, this family that much. I mean, it really is politically astute. Keep the power local, develop loyalties and whatnot. And I kind of see David playing this, not playing the same game, but recognizing that same human mm-hmm. dynamic, mm-hmm. says, okay, we'll take a heap of this and we'll give it to that village. Mm-hmm. And if the village wants to change a new headman because he's greedy, they will.
Right.
But it's really a good way of doing
it.
This
is.
In some
it
ways.
Is. It is. I mean, it's a good way to do it, period, but it's also politically astute. And that is going to pay its benefits, dividends, as we see in 2 Samuel. It's going to pay its dividends because Judah is going to be loyal to David.
This is more of a comment, David. Thank you. This has been very interesting. Whenever I see a list of places mentioned, like we mm-hmm. ran through toward the end of chapter 30, it makes me think, among other things, that the Old Testament kind of sets up a pretty large target for itself in the sense that by mentioning a lot of different place names and people and kings, it kind of lays itself out there to be verified archaeologically, you know, as time goes on. And that strikes me as very, as a good thing, I guess, because, and as a potential powerful set of evidence of the veracity of the Old Testament.
I think that's true. On the short run, what has happened is archaeologists have gone out and they have dug up these places and they've said, well, this must be the city of Beth Shan. Well, they don't find a sign that says Beth Shan. They're just guessing. They use various clues and they say, well, this must be Beth Shan. And they'll dig it up and they'll say, well, there's no evidence of Philistine occupation of this city. So the Bible's wrong. That has happened many times over the last few decades. But as archaeology progresses, as we find out more, someone comes along and says, you know what? I don't think that's Beth Shan at all. And they dig someplace else and find Beth Shan, and there's a Philistine lair. I mean, that has happened a number of times. So I think as time goes on, I'm convinced that the Old Testament will be more and more vindicated. And I would argue that's already happening now. But 50 years ago, the Old Testament, archaeology was disproving the Old Testament right and left. At least that's what they thought. So it is interesting to see how it has progressed. But I think as time goes on, that is much to our benefit that there are those kind of specifics, because I think they will be vindicated.
Does this book and the Old Testament say anything generally about how we should look at war? There's so much war, and it doesn't seem like there's a good explanation of why or mm-hmm. so.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about this a little bit this morning while I was making pancakes. I'm not sure that thinking about it helped, but first of all, I don't think it tells us much about war, because this is really a special case. But having said that, what is the difference between God telling the Israelites to go in and wipe out the Amalekites, every man, woman, and child, and every animal? What's the difference between that and the Taliban saying, go into this village in Afghanistan and kill all of the inhabitants because they have been disloyal to Islam? Is there any difference? And I would argue there is a world of difference between the two. To most people looking at the situation, it would be hard to tell the difference. To an AP correspondent, it might be very difficult to tell the difference. But I would say one is acting on what the God who is there actually said to do, and the other one is some kind of cheap imitation of that same thing. And how can you tell the difference? I think it's difficult superficially to tell the difference, But I think there would be a spirit of difference between the two. That the way that it's conducted, why it's conducted, the spirit behind doing it would be completely different, I think. And that one is justified in God's eyes and the other one is abominable in God's eyes. And I'm just struck by not just warfare, but let's talk about the Messiah. What's the difference between the Messiah and a loser? To the average person looking from the outside, it's hard to tell the difference. But to someone whose eyes have been opened by God, there is a world of difference between Jesus and a loser.
Is there any significance to Saul, the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons being burned?
I think that I'm assuming that it's just a way of respectfully dealing with the corpse of Saul and his men. That what it's in contrast to what the Philistines had done. The Philistines had put them on display to disgrace them. And the people of Jabesh-Gilead have given them a respectful burial. So I think that's the point.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you mean burning as opposed to burying or something like that?
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't... In Israel, as I understand it at this time, in some parts of Israel, they burned, and in some parts of Israel, they buried. It depended on whether they were influenced more by the Canaanites to the north or whether they were influenced more by the peoples further to the south. They adopted the customs of the peoples that they were most influenced by. And I don't remember whether burning is a Canaanite or a practice of the peoples further to the south. Okay? Thanks.